Well, I have the pleasure of introducing our panel. My name is Allison Christians. I'm the Heward Steichman Chair in Tax Law at the University of McGill, the Faculty de Droit. And so I was really very happy when they matched me with this panel, when I agreed to moderate, that I got put on this panel, Human Dignity, Economic Justice, and Democracy. It's something I think there is so much work here to be done and being done that I think is understated. People don't really know what's happening in this area. And we really find ourselves having to bridge a divide from technical knowledge to ability to get things going. So it says in your program, the panel will explore the link between economic justice and democracy. You can read the full description, but I think in the interest of time, we'll just get right to it. What I'll do is just introduce very briefly each of the panelists before they speak. They'll speak for 15 minutes each. And then we will skip the inter-panel conversation to go directly to audience Q&A after the four presentations. Okay, so without further ado, it's my pleasure then to, I think we'll start with Jacqueline. You're the first one on my program. Are you prepared for that, or did you arrange yourselves differently than was in the program? So are you still okay to go first?
Perfect.
So I will introduce you to Jacqueline Musitwa, who is an advisor in the Office of the Director General of the World Trade Organization. It's an amazing story of what she's doing there and creating a path to power. Really exciting. She's also the founder and managing partner of the Oja Law Group, a boutique law firm with offices in New York and Kigali, working on government, business, nonprofit, and investors on matters of political, corporate, and intellectual property law. That's all I'll give you. The rest of her extremely detailed bio is in your program. She's a very accomplished lawyer and I think advocate for justice. Thank you, Jacqueline. You've got 15 minutes.
Okay. Just stop me in case I keep going. It feels if the mic is too close. Okay. Thank you for attending our panel, but also thank you to the organizers. Thank you, Penny. This is my second time with the group. The first time was in Rwanda and it was an excellent experience, so hopefully this can be as good as Rwanda was. I'll start by kind of giving you kind of my background on how I ended up in economic justice. I grew up in Zambia in the 1980s, and at the time the government was humanist, which is a form of socialism. The government did great at keeping the country together and cohesive, so unlike a lot of African countries, from a tribal perspective, we were peaceful, everyone loved each other. From an economic perspective, we were awful. There were failed government policies, there was lack of capacity, commodity prices were low, and since copper was our main export, we were not doing too well. The economy was generally failing, and there were high levels of corruption. Now, the irony is that even though there were high levels of corruption at that time, corruption after we democratized has been worse than it was under socialism. Now, as a kid, you know, I didn't understand a lot of those things, but what the reality for me was spending Saturday mornings lining up for commodities like maize meal, which is the staple food, sugar, coke, anything you could think of that was not only luxury but also a necessity, we lined up for. And so for us, it was the highlight of my childhood was spending holidays in Zimbabwe, where we didn't have to line up for everything and where I could shop till I dropped. And for me, Zimbabwe was almost like heaven. And so it was pretty ironic when, about 10 years later, the tables turned. And the case of Zimbabwe, as all of you know, ended up being worse than Zambia ever was. Now, what I described, unfortunately, defines Africa in many ways. And so that is fleeting success, rags to riches to rags stories, and also a lot of contradictions. Now, despite that, I love Zambia, and I'm half Zambian. I also love Uganda, I'm half Ugandan. But I love Africa as a whole. And even though it is a work in progress, I think one thing that we do need to acknowledge is that Africa has come a very, very long way. Now, the impact of growing up in this situation has been a constant questioning on my part of how to really create economic transformation that results in economic justice, and also to make sure that as economics morph, it is actually deeply rooted and institutionalized, and it also is inclusive. We sit and we talk about all of the good figures, and the figures are great. But when I walk down the streets of Lusaka, when I walk down the streets of Maputo, Dakar, name it, it's quite different than the reality sometimes that is on paper. As a result, I have so far spent my career advising governments on investment and trade policy and how to become more competitive within the global sphere. I will actually give you some stats because the stats are impressive, and I think it is very important to kind of know what's happening with the Africa Rising story. And the Africa Rising story is coming up all over the place. Time Magazine, The Economist, McKinsey, Ernst & Young, everyone is focusing on it, and I think that it definitely is worth applauding Africa on the progress that is being made. As everyone knows, Africa definitely has a majority of natural resources as well as fertile agricultural land. Human capital, there are over 1 billion people, and the population is still growing. By 2035, Africa's labor force will be bigger than that of China's. In less than three generations, 41% of the world's youth will be African. And as considered a youth myself, at the moment, that is really, really concerning because a lot of the policies in place are a bit iffy, but I'll talk about that a bit later. At the moment, the continental median age is 20 years old. That is very, very low considering, you know, the median age in Europe and countries like Japan. And this is juxtaposed to the fact that our leaders on average are 62 years old. So something to think about for a minute. As far as politics, since 1990, more than 30 ruling parties or leaders have changed through a democratic process versus one between 1960 and 1990. From an economic front, six of the world's fastest growing economies are in Africa. Some of those are Ethiopia, Mozambique, Tanzania, Congo DRC, Ghana, Zambia, Nigeria. According to Mark Mobius, the chairman of the Templeton Emerging Markets Group, there are possibly over 200 hidden billionaires in Africa alone. Now, why are they hidden? That's also something I'm sure you'll ask during the course of the conversation. But a lot of it is because the structures are not in place tax people, and also because people are trying to evade whatever structures are there, it is sometimes easier to stay hidden. There definitely is a rise in Pan-African businesses. There are banks such as EcoBank, retail stores such as Nakomat, Massmart, which Walmart recently bought, that are spreading across the continent. So business is definitely looking good. There's increased investor confidence, and foreign direct investment has increased. From 2005 to 2010, it increased by 340 billion US dollars. Between 2001 and 2010, Africa's GDP averaged 5.2%. And for countries such as Rwanda, last year it was 8%. When you think about the US, which is growing about 1%, and Europe, which is around that range, it's pretty impressive. As far as trade, from the year 2000 to 2010, Africa's exports grew by 13%, and the global average was 9%. Africa's imports grew by 13%, and the global average was 8%. As far as the World Bank's Doing Business Report, which is now considered kind of one of the most prestigious and reliable means of determining how good it is to do business in one country or another, a lot of African countries, such as Rwanda, Mauritius, South Africa, have ranked very high on the list. In this year's report, five African countries ranked ahead of Italy and 15 ahead of China. There is a rising middle class with more disposable income, and so a lot of companies that typically did not look at Africa as a market are coming in, and it's everything from clotheslines such as Zara to name the alcohol companies. Heineken has its highest margins in Nigeria for beer, in case you didn't know. Champagne is also, you know, a hot commodity in Nigeria. There's over 50% mobile phone penetration, which is an amazing story from an innovation perspective, because it's not only simply calling and texting, but it's mobile phones being used to transfer money, mobile phones being used by farmers to develop their markets and sell their goods. So there's a lot of positive happening. Now, having talked about the positive, there are still a lot of challenges. And there are a lot of challenges that we need to deal with. I'll quickly go through the challenges, but then I'll focus on two where I see not only challenges, but where I see great opportunities. The biggest challenge, I think, is that of leadership. We have the case of the good, the bad, and the ugly. And so it really depends on the country. And I think it's very unfair to lump Africa as a whole, because I think that there are great leadership success stories that often don't get highlighted. But I would say on average, it's not good yet. Poverty rates are decreasing. The statistics used by, you know, the World Bank of a dollar a day is slowly changing, which I'm happy about because I thought that was very inaccurate. There is an infrastructure deficit. Energy, roads, name it. We definitely need more. I think that there is quick development happening at the moment, in part attributed to China. We can get into the China-Africa debate as we go on, but I definitely think China has played a significant role in increasing infrastructure in the past 10 to 15 years. Intra-African trade is unfortunately very low. So even though trade between Africa and the world has increased, within Africa it's only about 10 to 12% compared to over 60% of intra-European trade. So there's definitely a lot that needs to be done. Some of the reason that it is so low is, once again, attributed in part to infrastructure, non-tariff barriers, corruption, name it. Also, there are a lot of small landlocked countries, which makes it very hard for those countries to export their goods and get their goods to ports. So because Africa is so fragmented, it is really hard for Africa to trade within itself. There are also colonial legacies, but I definitely think that isn't as much an issue. We can talk about that as well. Now, what is the solution? The African Union last year decided to create a continental free trade agreement to be implemented by 2017, to say that within Africa there will be no tariffs if one country wants to export goods to another country. This sounds great, and I think it is a great plan. I think it's a bit optimistic, and 2017 is a bit too soon. I personally don't think we will be there by that point. The first step towards that is regional integration. I think there, so far, Africa is sectioned up pretty well, but I think the levels of integration vary. The East African community, in my opinion, has progressed the most, and I'm not biased, even though I am from the East African community. I think from a customs union perspective, from a movement, free movement of goods and people, I think a lot has happened. However, the East African community is still plagued by regional issues, such as conflict in the DRC, which borders Burundi, Tanzania, Rwanda, Uganda, as well as South Sudan, you know, north of Uganda. Access to finance continues to be a problem at all levels. Microfinance has boosted a lot of women out of poverty. And then there is large-scale investment, primarily in mining, but it's the missing middle where most of the jobs that need to be created for Africa to develop isn't actually there. Legal infrastructure is also lacking in a lot of countries. And a lot of my work to date has been drafting legislation for different countries to create a better enabling environment in which to invest. And I will say that there is a lot of work to be done. And it's everything from land ownership, insolvency, name it, it is a problem in most countries. So I would say those are the main challenges. Now, having said that, the two areas I think that need to be focused on before we can even talk about economic transformation or justice, for that matter, are leadership, or the lack thereof, and creating a mental shift within Africa. I'll start with leadership. There's been a lot of rhetoric within Africa about African solutions to African problems, which sounds great, and I'm a very big fan of. The problem is we haven't really defined what African solutions are. So we say, oh no, we need to make our own decisions, we don't want foreign intervention, and the like, which I think is great, but until we actually define what that is, it's problematic. I think one country that has done a very good job of defining itself and defining what it wants for itself has been Rwanda. I think a lot of that was definitely born of the genocide, and so it came about in different ways. One, the Gacaca courts, like them or hate them, it was a local decision to go. International justice will take however many years. And I worked for the special court for Sierra Leone that tried 11 people over the course of 10 years. Come on. And when you have a country devastated by war in which you need justice immediately, you cannot wait for the international community to come in and, you know, make those decisions. Now, we can talk about that, you know, afterwards as well. Rwanda also decided, what are we going to do for the poorest of the poor? What do we value as a society? And the conclusion was cows. So we will target whoever are the poorest of the poor, and we as government will give them a cow. The cow will not only help them, you know, with milk and meat and whatever else, but it was, now you can start to develop your own lives on your own land with something that is culturally valued and something that you, I mean, culturally, yes, is valued, but it is yours, and it is yours to take care of, and yours as a community to figure out how to breed. Okay, I will go ahead and hurry up. What do we need for leadership? I think we need more youth involvement. Very quickly, I think we also need more women's involvement. I think it was great. Sirleaf Johnson was elected. Great. We have Joyce Banda. Great. That's not enough. I think to have two female figures in 54, 55 countries, depending on how you count the number of countries in Africa, is appalling. Once again, I think Rwanda has done a great job at first having a quota of women in parliament, but then after the quota was reached to actually realize women are equal contributors and women can actually make a difference. And I don't think that has happened in most of Africa. In addition, I think leadership needs to be values-based. Right now, leaders come in and they tumble in and they just happen to be there. Their policies oftentimes do not make sense, but there's also nothing guiding them. There is no mission, and I think that that needs to change. As far as the mental shift, I think that we need to focus on moving forward and long-term planning. We do not plan long-term, and I think that that is problematic. We look at the next couple of years, depending on where aid money is coming from and depending on where USAID decides. We have a project for 2 years, great, we will plan for 2 years. And beyond that, no one is thinking forward. I think in the past couple of years, several governments have started trying to. So Rwanda has a 2020 vision, Kenya has a 2030 vision, Zambia has a 2030 vision. And I think it's great to plan. The next point after planning is execution. And I'm not sure a lot of countries, or I don't think a lot of countries are doing well on that part. I also think that there's a need to focus on local needs. And local needs within contracting and as well as laws. A lot of countries do not have laws on local content, which is why I think there's rising discontent about Chinese investment in Africa. If you do not have a minimum of what locals should have, don't get upset when foreigners come in and negotiate contracts that leave out locals. And I think that there are ways of safeguarding local rights if you put it into legislation and if you enforce it. I think education systems also need to be revamped. A lot of education systems, including the one that I went through in Zambia, are based off pretty much the 1960s. And my education in Zambia, I mean, I went to a public school in Zambia. I didn't know otherwise. I thought it was fine. And it wasn't until I went to the US that I realized that my education was really outdated. I think that also in education, rather than focusing on rote learning, I think that we need to focus more on skills. I think there's definitely a place for college, but I definitely think vocational training is not being focused on, and I think that the issue of unemployed youth could definitely be taken care of if more vocational skills were imparted on youth. Within that also, some people disagree with this one, but I do think most countries do need a form of national service, where above a certain age, people will go into a program where they can learn vocational skills for a year to two. Not only will it keep them busy, but it will teach them certain skills and that they aren't learning in high school. The last one for the mental shift is entrepreneurship. I think that we are very good at focusing on getting into great government jobs and great civil service jobs, but I think that we are not really cultured as a people to think entrepreneurship. You become entrepreneurs because I am hungry, I need to sell tomatoes. But I don't think we are taught from a young age to really sit down and go, you can make this profitable above and beyond selling 3-4 tomatoes a day, but to really developing an industry and a business that goes beyond you just making tomatoes. Your next step can be getting money from a bank to can tomatoes. Your next step can be exporting tomatoes if you really want to. So that is
It's not enough time. Just wonderful. Thank you so much. Thank you. So much in there. Thank you so much for those fascinating remarks. So now we'll move to Daniel Cordova. Daniel Cordova is the president of Instituto Invertir, a nonprofit organization that seeks to promote economic development in Peru. And he said, full stop right there. You can read the rest of his bio. Also, lots of impressive accomplishments in there. And I know you've got to, oh, look at that. Thank you very much. We've got the PowerPoint. Here we go.
Thank you very much. Thank you for, I don't know if I have the microphone open. Thank you for the invitation. I am very glad to be here with all the, it's the first time I attend, and I'm very impressed and interested in all the presentation I have the opportunity to see here. Human dignity, economic justice, and democracy. I was scared about the subject because to put all this huge concept together is, I think, almost impossible. So I choose to start with beautiful photos of the three regions of Peru to encourage all the audience to visit my country that I like a lot, of course, from the coast, for the mountains, and for the forest. And I will talk about this general concept, but as everybody here, I guess, talking about the Peruvian reality that I am surprised to see that is in some way very similar to these success stories of Africa in the recent years. And I'm very surprised of this because I share almost all the concept I have heard about Africa. But a little bit because my French education, I want to start to put in place the concept first in order to apply those concepts to the Peruvian reality. Instead of human dignity, I want to just to talk about justice and the rule of law, because I think that the human dignity is related to a system that allow the people to have the same rights, and the rights are related to law and the rule of law. Instead of economic justice, that I think that is basically an impossible concept. Economic justice when it's not possible, like, you know, civil justice. No, if you want to have a economic equality, if everybody the equal in economics, you take the risk to become a communist country. No, it's not possible. But we can talk about economic development and the same opportunities and to enhance opportunities for everybody. And when we talk about democracy, and that is important for Latin America reality right now, I want to mean much more than the formal democracy, you know, the political democracy when you have elections, because there are some false democracies in Latin America right now. Just to see that the human dignity of the rule of law, we are aware that part of the population needs help. And that's a principle of the, but we want to be warned about this concept that or what we call in Latin America assistentialism, if we can say, use the word, that is the concept that considers that all the population needs help. You know, all the population needs a framework, but if you start to the old conception that all the population needs help, you can fail from an economic point of view. No, so the real problem is to be equal in face of the law and not by the law. No, everybody has to be, you know, it's very different to try by the law to establish that everybody is equal. No, I think that everybody must have the same rights. It's not the same. No, and what is the key is to have this, to have a decent life, to have civil rights and property rights protected by an authority and by a judicial system. And the whole framework of the new institutional economics is what I use in order to understand this system that create incentive for everybody be included in the system and became an entrepreneur or became a person who is included in the economic system, and to prevent the risk against the risk of have an opposition of market-oriented economy or a capitalist economy that I think that with all the problems they have is the best system that we have, we know now. In terms of economic development, just evidence shows that the a market-oriented economy has been the most efficient system to reduce poverty. Now there is a now famous Spanish economist called Sade Martin, who shows this relationship between economic freedom and reduction of poverty. It's a kind of combination of a market economy, an institutional framework that enhances entrepreneurship and private investment. No. The role of the state in this framework is should be limited to the protection of civil rights and property rights. No? And the public service, like water, must be managed by a private regulated companies. And that's very important. Just a detail. In Lima, Peru, for example, it's a 9 million people city. 100% of the people have access to communication, cell phones, and because the sector was privatized 20 years ago. 100% of the people have electricity. 99%, because there's some places, of course, that but the basically, you have these two basic services that are functioning at 100%. 80% of people has water. And it's 20% of people, I mean, 1 million, more than 1 million, 1.5 million people in Lima that don't have water in their houses. It's a state-owned company. A very corrupt state-owned company. So the conception for us is clear, that economic development model and for public education and health services, the best solution has been the private-public partnerships. And then the formal democracy and the real democracy. And we are very clear right now, there are two models in Latin America right now. The real democracy countries, and it doesn't mean, you know, you have basically Chile, Peru, Colombia, even the Uruguay and countries that have left-wing president that have real democracies, democracies that have free press and balance of power and, of course, elections. But you have also these false democracies. No, and the false democracies are Venezuela, even Argentina, two big countries that are now have this formal election, but in fact, these parties of organization use the power, use the elections to legitimate their dictatorship. And it's clear that these countries are the countries that are in a worse economic performance. No, and there is no press freedom, of course, and there is a lot of corruption, a lot of corruption. No, in Argentina, there is public that the presidential family has increased their wealth in 4, 5, 6 times during the period of being president. No, so. These three concepts, I think, that are important just to show you what can we apply this conceptual framework to our reality. So basically, strong institution, real democracy, social inclusion and economic freedom, the four of these phenomena have to be together in order to have a real economic development and a decent life for people. So what happened with Peru? This is the GDP per capita of my country in the past century. We have these two tragic decades, the 70s and the 80s, and I remember very well, and I am old enough to remember this time, also with the queues for having these commodities and the same same situation. We have during this period, basically, in part a military dictatorship, in part democracy, but we have a socialist model with the most important companies state-owned that were expropriated, a closed economy, high tariff. We were a very a bad country in relationship with the external debt and so on. And what happened in the early 90s, the model changed dramatically because we were in the middle of a mess with 2,000% of inflation, with the shining path of the Maoist movement bringing jeopardy the whole system, with, of course, a lot of corruption, a mess in the whole system. So in the 90s, we have a dramatic change with reforms, privatization, open the economy, etc., etc. We have still a government that was not completely democratic. No, it was a kind of false democracy, but with a market-oriented economy. At the beginning of this century, we have a new model, with a real democracy, because Fujimori, that was the president who we discovered all these videos of the corruption of the government, was resigned and went to Japan because he was a part Japanese. Now he's in jail in Peru. After this period of market-oriented economy and kind of dictatorship, we have this a new model with a democracy and market-oriented economy, that is economic freedom and political freedom, that is, from my point of view, the best model to have a country with having growth and having working with all his potential to reduce poverty. So just some statistics, and we'll go very, very quickly. We have this average growth of 5.76% in 10 years. The GDP per capita growth of 4.7% in these 10 years. That is the most important growth in the last 50 years. We have Peru with average growth that is the most important in Latin America. No? To consume the confidence on the economy is positive. We have the lowest inflation in the region. We have reduced our debt to 7% internal and 7% external related to the GDP. No, and that's a financial success. So the public debt of Peru, in comparison with all the developed countries, very reduced. No, we are accumulating international reserve, no, dollars and gold and so on in the central bank. We are considered an investment grade country by the financial institutions. The sol is stronger than the dollar, and now in the past 10 years. No, the soil has become stronger than the dollar, the money. And the most important of all, of course, that the poverty has been reduced from 54% in 2001 to 28% in 2011. And the extreme poverty from 24% in 2001 to 6.3% in 2011, and that is the most important, of course, achievement of this economic model. What is behind the scenes? And this is a book I wrote about the poor entrepreneurs who don't become rich, but became successful people related to microfinance. That is another similarity. Peru is the most successful country in microfinance in the region. The graph shows four kinds of microfinance institutions. The more popular are the regional banks, and then you have formal banks, and all the system has been changed to allow the microfinance to be formal. And in fact, microfinance has become the link between the formal and the informal world. And the book I've written, financed by a microfinance institution, is histories about this new reality, no? Of people who came from the countryside, who were very poor, and with their own effort and with the help of microfinance, became people who have a very good standard of living right now. And the other thing I can tell you is that was the first one. What the book I wrote about it is a kind of this is a fellowship that my institution offers to the young Peruvian from the countryside, and we give this fellowship every year to 200 students from the countryside, and we show them that they can become entrepreneurs because they don't in the education system that is outdated. The same that in Africa, we don't have. They don't have courses about the possibility of becoming entrepreneurs, or courses about entrepreneurship. So when we open the eyes of these young, you can see them that we change their lives, and they have established this. We have already 60 companies established in the regions, no, related to this the five groups we have already. Trained in Lima during 1 week each. And just to finalize the paradox, because it's not only a success story, we still have, of course, a lot of problems. We are still a poor country. I'm not saying that we are becoming a developed country, not at all. And we have basically two bottlenecks right now. The first one is the social opposition to private investment, and it's justified for many reasons. And the second one is another, the paradox I'm talking about in this money, is to have governments with money, but unable to invest it. I mean, the problem now of infrastructure, or the problem of the investment in the country, is not that we don't have money. We have accumulated a lot of money. The government has money, have reduced its debt, but they don't have the management skills to invest it, no? So the social problems are the opposition to the, for example, the mining investment, and I'm working on that, and we can talk about that afterwards. Have reduced a little bit the stops on projects, and there's a perception among the businessmen that the government is not able to promote private investment. The budget are not executed, the government is keeping the money, they are not investing all, and what we have in conclusion is this situation. No? I think that we have a real democracy, we have social inclusion related to this economic development process, no? But we don't have strong institutions. We have a very bad judicial system, we have a very bad police, corrupted, we have so many problems in the institutional that we have to work on that in order to really become a developing country. We are not yet a developing country. We have improved a lot, but we have to work a lot in more than in economics, in institutions. Sorry.
I'm sorry. That was wonderful. They're like telling me to put the pressure on you, but there's so much to say. Again, yes, of course. Thank you so much. Wonderful. Really wonderful. I don't like interrupting the flow.
You
there.
Must.
That was,
yes.
I know. I'm going to get myself in trouble. So then we're, yes, are you coming back? Okay, is it much easier to see? Of course, yeah, you couldn't see it behind your head there. We had to guess what was going on behind there. So thank you. All right, so now I'm very pleased to introduce you to Anuradha Mittal. founder and executive director of the Oakland Institute, an internationally renowned expert on trade development, human rights, and agriculture issues. And again, an extensive bio with many accomplishments in the folder. I encourage you to read them. Take it away.
Thank you
so much.
First of all, thanks to everyone who's made this incredible conference happen. So my gratitude for allowing me space to be here. It's a non-brainer that economic development, well-being of communities and people is a must for good governance and democracy. As people say, hungry people are angry people. The best way to keep public revolts, revolution down is to have a good, healthy middle class. It is with that thinking that we've also seen a lot of talk of investment happen, that investment is going to be a must, and it is a must, especially in developing countries, and a lot of policies, as you mentioned, to facilitate such investments are at work. A lot of development agencies, institutions such as the World Bank are hard at work doing that. I work at a place called the Oakland Institute, which is a policy think tank, and we have been looking at one such mode of investment, which is land investments, which have been promoted as a win-win scenario, especially since the high food price crisis of 2006-2007. You've had rich nations, such as the Gulf states, but food insecure, trying to find ways to secure their food supply. You have countries such as India, which are looking for lands and resources, water, for being able to export foods. You also have the financial crisis, which the dot-com world impacted, and with your housing market gone, you're looking for the next soft commodity to invest in, and agriculture with its fundamentals, growing population, is very attractive. And it has created a land rush, investment in land, and that's what we have been studying, that is it really a win-win scenario for both those investing and the communities where it's being invested, or economies. In the course of that, we have done this work over the last 5 years, looked at over 100 land deals, predominantly in Africa, because Africa is held as such a poster child, that this would lead to economic development. It'll improve livelihoods, it'll create jobs, it'll improve food security. Africa can feed herself and the rest of the world. So we have kind of done very detailed research, specifically around Cameroon, Ethiopia, Tanzania, Mozambique, Zambia, South Sudan, which country am I forgetting? I'm sure some few others. And we're just starting work in Papua New Guinea. So just to kind of share in my minutes, and when I get to 10 minutes, can you give me a pointer so I don't go over? Yeah. So just to share some of our key findings from that, that what does this kind of investment mean before I go into my punchline? Yes, we have seen a lot of agencies promoting such investment, for instance, the doing business ranking that you mentioned, but I think it's important to recognize that how do they rank? It is not based on the situation of human rights or respect for labor laws. Business ranking is done by the amount of agricultural land that is available without producing facts from where this research came from. Without talking about labor laws, it is based on low labor costs, it is based on easy facilitation of securing lands without talking about free prior informed consent that all of us that should be concerned about. So according to Doing Business Ranking of the World Bank, Georgia is one of the best countries to do business in. So just to kind of put it out there, we've seen a lot of investment agencies with the help of World Bank be set up, whether it is Tanzania Investment Center, whether it is Zambia Development Agency, CPIA in Maputo. I could rattle off a whole list of them. What's very interesting is that they have different names. But when you go to their websites, it is identical language. They all promise investor statuses, all of that. Of course, language written by some technocrats and some policy advisors, and of course, by the World Bank officials. Having said that, let me share what our findings were. We found in 2009 alone, 56 million hectares of land was leased or bought by foreign investors in developing world, with over 70% of that being in Africa. That is the size, almost the size of France. That much land has been taken away for so-called agricultural investments. And as I mentioned, most of it is in Africa, but also in Asia and Latin America. Who are the investors? You might say, we're talking about China. Actually, we found just about everyone from Swedish, Norwegian churches who are investing in timber operations in Mozambique. We found in South Sudan the largest land deal involving 1 million hectares of land sold, given away for 90 years for $25,000, went to the U.S. ambassador, former ambassador for refugee affairs, The guy had the right to cut down the primary forest. He could go look for oil and whatever, and had the right to sublease it. Of course, when we put out the contract in public domain, people who are coming back after a very bloody war marched up to Juba 2 years ago when I was there, and they can still meet with the president and say, we didn't fight a bloody war to keep Khartoum out so the U.S. ambassador can move in. The president canceled the deal. In Tanzania, we exposed the largest land deal involving 800,000 acres of land involving Iowa investor Bruce Rastetter, a Republican kingmaker, who was telling the world and investors that nobody lives on this land. It is unproductive land. We did field work to find 160,000 smallholder farmers were farming, producing food for the communities, and this big Iowa guy would have displaced them with nowhere to go, so he could grow GMO corn for agrofuels. So in terms of the investors, they are Chinese, they're Indians, the largest investors in Ethiopia, but you know, private equity funds from Thiacref, the largest pension fund in the U.S., to your emergent asset management, from Europe, from U.S., everyone is involved. It's a new form of taking Africa. There's no other way to put it. Secondly, what we found was, in terms of just the lot of myths that are put out, that we need this investment for economic development, I'll share just a quick story. I was in Zambia, where they have launched agricultural block scheme where they're inviting proposals from outside investors to develop this 1 million hectares of land, and I met with a very senior official in the ministry and the land commission and asked them why they were giving away 1 million hectares of land, and this gentleman, actually the minister, says, well, this is for poverty alleviation, you know, language straight out of the World Bank. And I was like, how do you plan to do that? Are you asking investors to pay for that land? And he says, oh, no, you just have to put in a proposal with a $5,000 bid. The fees of putting in the proposal is $5,000, and that's it. I was like, okay, so you're planning to develop and alleviate poverty by asking for infrastructure? He says, oh, no, we took a World Bank land. We have put all the infrastructure in for you. And I'm like, well, are you going to ask us to create jobs, certain number? And he says, no, just some general language around employment creation would be good enough. I'm like, are you going to ask me to do environmental social impact assessment? He said, you know what, we don't have Greenpeace here. When you take 20,000 hectares of land, I expect you to do the Brazilian thing, burn it down. So I was like, will you help me understand how will poverty alleviation and economic development happen? And this guy comes close to me, smiles, and says, you and I both know, you're not here. He was thinking I'm an investor, that you're not here for promoting the well-being of Zambia. Here's my Gmail account. If you're interested in your proposal, winning the bid, write to the Gmail address, not my government address. Zambia Development Agency offers a thing called IPA, Investment Protection Promotion Agreement, through which if I invest $10 million, I get 30 years of not having to pay any profit taxes. I don't have to pay import duties. I get strategic investor status. People who talk about food security, I even get the protection that, God forbid, there's a shortage of food in Zambia, people are on the streets protesting, I will have the right to export 80% of the food grown and stored in Zambia outside the country. And if people revolt and the government is toppled, then the World Bank, MIGA, Multilateral Investment Guarantee Agency, will move in to protect my investment. So for economic development, when we crunch the numbers, all of this research is on our website. Even IMF agrees there's no benefit for countries such as Zambia, who are giving away their water, their land. In terms of taxes and revenues, there's nothing. On top of that, I'm allowed 100% repatriation of profits. This is not brain surgery. This is looting Africa all over again in terms of investment. In terms of food security, again, looking at over 100 land deals, most of them are either for food for export, flowers for export, or for agrofuels, biofuels. They don't feed people. In terms of jobs, again, our research, which is also verified, if you look at FAO, Food and Agriculture Organization, and IFAD, in Africa, 5 acres, and this is a big number, of arable land is enough to sustain a family, and you can imagine at least 5 family members. So if you think about 5 acres sustaining 5 people, you see land deals of 100,000 hectares of land. They say they will create jobs. Large mechanized farms don't create jobs. They produce menial jobs, seasonal employment, and they at most might hire 1,000 people without paying them good wages and the rest. This 100,000 hectares of land could sustain 20,000 people at least. So, you know, the figures, if we talk about well-being of people, this whole idea of plantations, large-scale commercial agriculture, feeding Africa, and economic development is nothing else but lies and what we call greenwashing and poor washing, using the poverty of Africa to loot her again. I could just go on about all the different findings that we have, but basically it's not a win-win scenario. It is definitely a win-win for whoever's gone in as investors, but there's a lot of speculation. In fact, I'll never forget Susan Payne, who used to be CEO of Emergent Asset Management, actually having a video up on their website saying we could be moronic and not grow food and we would make money, talking about investments in Africa. Now, the way these morons plan to make money is through land speculation. So they're grabbing land, they're grabbing water. This is not unused, unproductive land. These are the most fertile lands that they're taking over so they can then turn around and sell it to the highest bidder. Lessons for development, since I'm getting to the close of my 15 minutes, I would say it's very interesting that one is not against investment. In fact, one of the biggest reasons for food insecurity and economically not doing well, whether you look at Asia or Africa or Latin America, is that there has been no investment in agriculture. Most of the economies of these countries are in agriculture, and yet these countries have been told not to invest in agriculture. If you look at rural banks, you look at microfinance, none of that has been available for the smallholder farmers. So if you look at just what is being provided to foreign investors in terms of providing infrastructure, providing them access to markets, providing them all kind of tax breaks, if even a small iota of that was provided to the smallholder farmers who form the bulk of the world's poor, and in fact the bulk of the world's hungry, situation would be totally different. So the question is not one of that do we need new solutions for how to feed people, how to clothe people, how to shelter people. We know how to do that. The question is how do we remove those from power who prevent that from happening, and that is the biggest problem. And there we need to look at the international geopolitics of corruption, which allows corrupt political elites to live and be in power in Africa, in Asia. It's not in a genetic makeup or DNA makeup to be corrupt, but it is actually fostered very often by a lot of outside agencies. So at the Oakland Institute, we do believe in investment. Investment in agriculture is important, but the question that needs to be asked is what kind of investment and investment for who? Just putting in money doesn't mean that GDP grows up and it trickles down. We all know that top-down approach of development has never worked. And I'll conclude by saying that just this February, we brought some Ethiopian activists. I didn't even get to talk about Ethiopia, where 1.5 million people are being forcibly displaced, predominantly indigenous communities, the Bodis, the Mursis, the Suris in Lower Omo, and the Anuaks in Gambela, which thanks to USAID, DFID, and World Bank support, through the villagization scheme of Ethiopia, are being displaced from their lands to clear way for large-scale plantations where the Malaysians, Chinese, Indians will come in. And there's very, very, the worst kind of human abuses that we have ever seen around our work around land rights all over Africa. So India being the largest investor, we were able to bring some of the Ethiopian activists this February to India to speak to India's policymakers and the media and civil society that India, formerly a colonized country, is turning into a colonizer. And it was very interesting when an Ethiopian activist said 1.5 million people are being displaced, and this Indian activist said for so-called development projects, you only have 1.5, we have displaced 60 million people, predominantly indigenous within India. And of course, we would call it the largest democracy, right? So the question I want to leave with you is, when we talk about development, we think of it as a really good omelet. We'll have to break some eggs to make an omelet. The question is one of free, prior, informed consent. Who are those eggs that are being volunteered for the so-called larger common good? What is that larger common good? The well-being of 250,000 Indians who, a small fraction of this billion people who earn huge incomes, or 65% of India's working people who earn less than 35 cents a day. So the question is one of equity and not just economic development. You cannot have true democracy and you cannot have true genuine economic development which is not built on the foundation of human rights. Otherwise, you would just have dictatorships. You can call it whatever you want.
I don't know if you took the breath that whole time.
hiding somewhere. Wonderful. Thank you so much. And actually on time. That was no thanks to me. Alana, where did I put my sheet so I can introduce you? I might be able to do it without my notes. So to round out the panel and pull it all together.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. McGill Law School's very own Alana Klein. She's an assistant professor of law at McGill. She teaches courses on criminal law and poverty law. And she works a lot on governance and decision making and how that impacts marginalized groups and individuals in decentralized and privatized systems. Alana.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Allison. I'd like to begin today by thanking the organizers, particularly Colleen Shepherd and Nandini Ramanujam, for having invited me to participate here. I'd also like to extend my warmest thanks to the Eckenberg family, Penny and Gordon, for making this possible. It's a real honor to be a part of this conference. And finally, I'd like to thank the student organizers who I've seen rushing around doing so much, you've done an amazing job, so thank you very much. And finally, I'd like to thank my co-panelists. I don't think I have their ability to recall every statistic relevant to what I'm saying at every moment, so I'm going to rely a little more heavily on my notes. But I've really enjoyed your talk, so thank you very much. Now, according to the introduction in your program, I'm here to discuss the relationship between economic justice, democracy, and of course, as is the subject of this conference, human rights. And your program, in the little intro blurb, talks about how failures to ensure the inclusion and participation of citizens can render struggling democracies fragile. What I would argue is that the growing focus in human rights on inclusion, on participation, on the need for better democracies to ensure economic justice, so not ostensible democracies or even poor democracies, has relevance not just for struggling democracies, but also for Canada, an ostensibly thriving democracy. And the example that I'll use to talk about this is the right to the highest attainable standard of health, which includes the understanding that there should be an equitable distribution of healthcare resources within countries, or at the very least, we should be moving toward equitable distribution of healthcare resources in countries. Yet here in Canada, you may or may not be surprised to know, there have recently been some studies that have been released on this in the last even week or two, people are increasingly paying for healthcare out of pocket, or very frequently are unable to pay for healthcare out of pocket. And there are a number of reasons for this, but the biggest is that back in the 1960s to the 1980s, when our government-funded healthcare system was established, healthcare was defined as including hospital and physician services. And other services were funded or not at provincial discretion. Since that time, we've come to understand healthcare much more broadly than we did. It extends far beyond hospital and physician services to include things like home care, pharmaceuticals, complementary therapy. And these are the kinds of things that we're paying for either with our own private insurance or if we don't have private insurance that we're not benefiting from at all. Some folks would call this passive privatization. And this passive privatization has had the impact of denying often people, members of the lower middle class, but certainly the very poor, access to some health care that others are able to enjoy. Now, I raise this as an example because what I'm suggesting in this little talk that I have, in the few minutes that I have, is that there are new developments within human rights that are making it possible for human rights to provide some insights or some impetus for change for this kind of situation here in Canada. When human rights scholars and activists think of economic justice and human rights, usually our minds turn to social and economic rights, or the rights contained in the International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights. These are rights to things like food, water, housing, healthcare, education, welfare, and the like. And since the subject of this conference is democracy, I wanted to point out that these rights are often considered to be interdependent with democracy. And of course, it's easy to understand how fulfillment of these kinds of rights is necessary for meaningful participation in democracy. As a number of my co-panelists have noted. It's very hard to participate meaningfully in the political sphere when your stomach is chronically empty, when you have nowhere to live, or even when, perhaps less dramatically and more commonly, you're just struggling to make ends meet. Moreover, the UN has emphasized in a number of statements that democracy is, and I think this is interesting, a natural environment for the protection and realization of human rights. Basically, at least according to UN orthodoxy, democratic countries are less likely to be human rights abusers. The cynics among you may say that this makes you think of some faulty stereotypes that have led to the persistent myth that democratic countries never go to war with one another. It's not true, they do. Nonetheless, the idea is that more democratic, inclusive, participatory decision-making will lead to better human rights realization, and this lies at the center of recent developments in our understanding of social and economic rights. So today what I'd like to do is to talk about how one such right, the right to health, has come to focus on enhancing democracy, and why this presents new opportunities for those thinking about human rights, even in developed countries like Canada. So first I'll discuss a few challenges posed by this new emphasis, and then finally, I'll discuss some challenges posed by this new emphasis on democratic processes within social and economic rights. So in other words, I'm going to argue that this notion that we need to enhance democracy in our decision-making about healthcare both helps us in Canada, but also presents some new challenges for human rights advocates working in this context here. So I'd like to start.
You have lots of time.
I have lots of time.
Yeah, I'll tell you at 10.
Okay.
Take a breath.
First of all, I'd like to, there's just so much to say.
I know, the energy's palpable.
So much to say. So for many years, the human rights scholars and certainly the lawyers and law students and advocates among you probably are aware that economic and social rights, those rights that are tend to be most closely associated with economic justice, were viewed as kind of second-class citizens in the human rights world, somehow of lesser importance than civil and political rights, like the right to be free from torture, the right to vote. And certainly, even if people thought they were as important, they certainly thought that they were less susceptible to enforcement. They were also viewed as much more important to developing than to developed countries. That is, there was this idea that developing countries had much further to go in realizing economic, social, and cultural rights. And the reasons for this lesser status and for this focus or lack of focus on developed, so-called developed countries are complicated, but I'm going to cite two. One is that social and economic rights are potentially far more expansive than what we traditionally understood as civil and political rights. The very wording of the protections makes that clear. Article 12 of the International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights, the right to health, the one that I'm relying on, speaks about the right to the highest attainable standard of health. So that's ambitious. And perhaps for this reason, because of the ambition of the rights are subject to what we've called progressive realization. That is, states are required to take steps to the maximum of available resources with a view to progressively achieving the full realization of rights. And the problem with that is that it's made it harder for human rights advocates and monitoring bodies to say, this is a violation, right? And it's especially clear in the healthcare context, right? You might cancel certain kinds of services, that is, stop covering certain kinds of services in order to cover other kinds of services. In those kinds of contexts, it's very hard to tell whether you're advancing or not advancing. Another reason for this persistent marginalization of social and economic rights relates to historical context, and I think that that's very important. An expansive right like the right to the highest attainable standard of health doesn't quite fit with the traditional vision of rights that took hold after the Second World War, when human rights came of age, really. Which, and I won't go into too much historical detail here, were basically understood as rights to be free from oppressive government intervention. Social and economic rights don't fit easily with that paradigm that suggests that the biggest threat to your human rights, the biggest threat to your freedom, is the overweening, abusive state that will torture you, that will deny you your right to vote, for example. And so, until recently, theorists who were interested in economic, social, and cultural rights tried to make them more meaningful by bounding their content, by limiting their content. And so, for example, theorists would talk about this idea of the minimum core content of rights. The notion that we couldn't say, for example, what the highest attainable standard of health is with certainty from the outset, but we can at least say that people should have access to, for example, basic emergency care, accurate information about reproductive health, for example. The problem with this kind of approach is that basic emergency care in Canada is often, sometimes it is, but it's often not the most important issue or not the biggest injustice. So I opened with the injustice of the fact that our healthcare system is slowly and gradually privatizing, with the impact being that those with less are enjoying worse health outcomes increasingly over time, even in a country like Canada.
So there's 10.
Great. And emergency care is not going to address that disparity. And historically, the right to the highest attainable standard of health contained in economic international human rights instruments, rather, has done relatively little to change that reality, despite the fact that it's understood to guarantee in some fashion equitable distribution of health resources. But recently, what we've seen is a sort of a shift in approach, and this is where I started from. UN actors have started to be, and human rights scholars and activists have started to be less shy about this notion of progressive realization. And there are a few reasons. One is that we're no longer perceiving threats to human dignity and agency as coming solely or even primarily from overweening and abusive states. Instead, in a world with increasing liberalization, deregulation of governments, increasing power, as we've talked about in some of these panels, of corporations and other private interests, we're much more worried about our governments basically acting as industry shills. Goodness knows we saw this in the economic crisis in the United States, and a more modest example here in the Canadian healthcare context is many commenters who have blamed the inability of our healthcare system to adapt to our changing needs by funding what people actually need more of, capture by the medical profession. And so in this context, what the human rights activists, norm entrepreneurs, scholars and actors have done is they've said, well, instead of understanding social and economic rights as including this minimum core, we are going to expect our human rights system to demand that governments be accountable for their policies and for their policies' impacts on the poor and the most marginalized. And so, for example, if you look at current interpretations of the right to health, they include things like this. There are obligations for states to adopt and implement a national public health strategy that's based on evidence, that addresses the needs of the whole population, that's developed transparently, that's monitored for its actual effectiveness at distributing healthcare in an equitable way, using things like indicators and benchmarks. It also has to be developed in consultation with the most marginalized and vulnerable groups and pay special attention to their needs. In other words, and this is all, you know, big human rights language, but in other words, we need to go beyond saying a healthcare system has to include access to emergency care and essential drugs, and instead we say we need to make sure that our healthcare allocation decisions are made democratically, beyond ordinary democratic processes, because voting once every 4 years is not enough. So the international human rights system is much more concerned with ensuring that there is democratic participation at a much more frequent level. We've also seen new dynamism around tools like we've heard talked about by this panel, like requiring branches of government to do human rights impact assessments for all the new policies that they're going to introduce. So, for example, when government denies prison needle exchange on the basis of a zero tolerance to drugs policy, we need to ask whether and how that actually affects the health of inmates. The answer is, and the data is very clear on it, negatively. So the idea might not sound that revolutionary, but it actually represents quite a huge change in human rights methodologies. That is, that states themselves are required to explain what their impacts of their policies are on poor and marginalized people. And I'm not sure whether this change is a good thing or a bad thing in a way. It's still, I think, too early to tell. On the one hand, finally, we can use human rights tools to extend beyond this basic level need that has had little impact on a country like Canada. On the other hand, it might give rise to a lot of difficult questions that I think we're going to have to start beginning to contend with. First of all, how are we going to select our indicators? How are we going to put together our statistics? Perhaps more importantly, when we ask states to provide copious data on how their health policies are protecting people's human rights, particularly marginalized people's human rights, we place an extraordinary burden on claimants to make use of that data. Mm-hmm. So we imagine that rights claimants are going to be able to hear all this data that's being generated by government and then be able to push through these renewed democratic channels for change. But of course, as one cynical scholar has observed, in relation to the Supreme Court of Canada's use of data to deny constitutional social welfare claims, you cannot beat the experts. In other words, those data are going to be very easily susceptible to manipulation. So the idea that we're going to protect human rights by providing data to poor and marginalized people maybe raises a few important questions. And this is where I'll conclude on this. Finally, as we're moving away from things like naming, shaming, and litigating, and toward indicators, are we counting the poor instead of providing them with remedies? In other words, when will all this count? In other words, there's a risk that all this counting is going to lead to more political discourse about health, but it might not actually lead to rights enforcement. So I think I will end there since I'm out of time, and that's a good reason to end.
Thank you.
That was very good. Thank you.
Just so much in there. Thank you so much. That was a very good way to pull some of these things together. So now, when we had extra time, the idea was that we would talk to each other, and that's the portion we're going to forego, which is really too bad. I think we have a lot to say to each other, and what we'll do is we'll use your questions to do that, right, sort of deviously getting our responses in to each other. So I'm not sure how does this work. Do we have a microphone system, or do, yes, we do. So it looks like there's a microphone stand there. You can't just speak because it won't register on the videotape. And if you just speak, I will have to repeat your question for the VF. So it's better if you would just come up to the mic. And I'm just going to see what time is it right now. 4:45, and we were hoping to go till about 5:15, I think was the idea. Yes? So we've got about half an hour to get a few questions in. Just before you do that, can I just add to what was already said my thanks for just the privilege of having this panel to chair. And I'm not contributing anything but just nervously trying to point at the clock, which I have not liked to do. These have been some fascinating presentation remarks, I think, because then we could have listened to a lot more, I'm sure, in each case. So I want to thank the conveners, all of the supporters, the students, and most especially my panelists. Thank you so much for just a rich array of intellectual problems for us to think about. Thank you so much. So we'll take the first question.
Thank you very much. My name is Magdas Mazgabu, and I'm from Ethiopia, and I'll be speaking tomorrow on the closing plenary. So I have a few questions for the panel. The first one is for Muna. You talked about Africa rising and the success story behind Africa, especially economically, in the last few years. I was wondering, in light of the panel that is being discussed here with democracy and human dignity, if democracy had any role in it, was that success story really in countries that are typically democratic or countries that are not democratic? And what's the role of democracy in that success story? Because from my opinion, some of the countries that you listed as rising, my own country, Ethiopia, Angola, and Rwanda, are not really typically democratic. And can we really play into that debate that says that some people say that democracy is not really necessary for economic development, and there are some who say that democracy isn't necessary for economic development? That's one. And the second question is, it's just a theoretical question, so one of you can answer. It's really, there are, you know, when we look at human rights, socioeconomic rights, and civil and political rights, and when we try to advance these rights, there are some cases where they come inherently in tension. For example, you mentioned about the land grabbing issue, which is a big issue in my country and all over Africa. And you mentioned that the issue there is that these land grabbing or this the land acquisition is not good for economic development, or it's not accruing economic development. So let's just assume that the land grabbing or the land acquisition is really transforming the economy. It is actually bringing up an economic transformation, economic development for centuries and a really, really background agrarian economies. So can we really justify like a short-term curtailment of rights, indigenous rights, or like civil and political rights for a long-term socio-economic development? Like, how do we really reconcile, you know, that there are some inherent tension between like going after socio-economic development at the expense of civil and political rights? Because we know in the Western developed countries, when they were growing in their socio-economic rights, civil and political rights did not really exist at the time. So how do we reconcile these two?
Thank you for those questions. So I think the first one is for you, Jacqueline, and then I think the second one is actually across, so we'll see what we have. Yeah.
Okay. I think like everything in Africa, as I said, it's a land of contradictions, right? I think it depends. I think for the countries that are rising, Ethiopia and Rwanda being two, the notion of democracy, I think, is being redefined at the moment. They're definitely not following a Western model of democracy in some ways, and in some ways they are. Kagame was elected by over 90% in the last election, which was 2011. Election observers didn't really dispute that. Now, one could argue he was elected by 90% because the main opposition leader was in jail. So, depends on how you put it. Ethiopia, Meles also did a very good job of keeping opposition in its place, so to say. And, you know, the economy is going great. I think that at this point in Africa, each country has to find its own solution of governance, and sometimes it may not necessarily align with Western democracy as we know it. I think for a country like Zambia, we don't have any negative stories, so to say. Well, in the past couple of months, there have been a few issues with the new president curtailing opposition parties, but prior to that, the economy was growing and there was social freedom across the board. I think based on the country, I think countries need to make the assessment, and right now for most African countries, people need to eat first. People need basic health care. People need housing, people need clothing. So until those basic needs are fulfilled, I'm a bit hesitant to argue for more developed social rights. Do they still have the right to vote? Yes. Now, do they necessarily vote freely? Probably not, because if I have to feed my kid and I can't, and you offer me a bag of corn, of course I'm going to vote for you. So I think that Africa is a work in progress. I think it's necessary to push Africa to be its best. But I think in many cases, it's a bit too early. I think that basic needs need to be fulfilled. And I think that countries like Rwanda and Ethiopia are in many ways, for the majority, trying to do that. It is unfortunately at the expense of a certain portion of a minority. And with your egg example, I haven't yet quite found a balance. Mm-hmm. The eggs need to be cracked.
How? Right, and that's, yeah, exactly, and I think that's the transition, isn't it, to the next question, which is there are going to be losers in this transition, and what is the acceptable amount of pain borne by what portion of the population to get these promised riches, right? Huh. I mean, am I understanding right?
So one last thing, actually, because when we look at economic growth, I also think it's a bit skewed. The numbers that we're using a lot of times are based on kind of the extractive industry. So I think we don't look at the holistic picture when we talk about these success stories. And I think until we do that, once again...
Right. We know the psychology of growth for its own sake is the logic of the cancer cell. So it doesn't mean that it's positive, right?
True. Like, Zambia is a middle-income country. I don't know how, frankly, because every time I go home, I'm shocked by what I think is increasing poverty. Zambia now even though, yes, we stood in lines and it was bad, there were no street kids when I was a kid. Fine, HIV came in, wiped out a good portion of the population. There's street kids all over the place now. Land issues. My mom calls me every other week and she's like, hey, do you have any extra money because you need to buy more land now? For the past few years, every birthday, I'm kind of like, don't buy me presents, just put more money in my land account. And so every couple of months, I am seeking out more land because my mom is like, your kids will not have land in this country at the rate we're going. And so as we discuss, you know, the rise and, you know, power, leadership, governance, I think, yeah, it goes deeper, which is why I said before we can even get to this conversation of economic prosperity, transformation, development, we need to go back to the very basic, which is leadership, and addressing the leadership deficit that is there in many countries.
I think that we are addressing I will talk about two subjects at that in the middle of the conversation. The first one is the relationship between the market economy development and institutions, and why institutions are important. And the second is the relationship between democracy and development. In terms of the logic of the market economy development, of course, has problems that must be solved by a strong institution and by a strong state. But doesn't mean that we need the state to kill the market economy, because in that case, we won't develop the economy. No? And that's in relation with agriculture. And I disagree about this vision that you should kind of avoid the private investment. You have to regulate the private investment in all the sectors that are related to public utilities and to land. Just an example. In my country, there was an agrarian reform in the 60s that killed agriculture, that killed the private companies in agriculture, because they say that, you know, the land must be in the hands of the people who work on the land. So they give the people, they expropriate all the farms, and they give the people the land. And of course, the people were not prepared to manage the land. So the agriculture was broken in Peru. And that was the most important problem of food security we have. No? Now, with all little by little, the private investment is returning to the agriculture, and we are in a much better shape to have food for the people with a market economy logic. Of course, we need regulation, for example, in the forest, in order to avoid this bad investment regarding the environment. No? But we cannot, I think with all the experience we have of socialist reform in the past, we cannot believe that the state can have the management of the food security. The state has to establish rules, property rights, regulations, but it's the private sector that must invest and generate this change. And we cannot have our own idea about that. And then a small comment about a sentence about the privatizations that have been not positive in some countries, maybe in Russia and other countries. Well, as I told in my presentation, in my country, in my city, Lima, I pay 10 times less than the poorest people in my city for water. Why? Because I have water. No? The company, the state-owned company, provides water for all the urban, modern part of the city. But 20% of the Lima population doesn't have water because it's a state-owned company that is not able to do that. And it's very corrupt. So they have water in trucks, no? And they have to pay 10 times more than me. The communication system, the electricity system is privatized, and everybody has, and you can put subsidized, and you can put all the system in order to, some people have a low cost and some people have high cost.
I wish
but the management, the management of the we, management of a state-owned company, by definition,
I can
is,
feel an
I
answer.
Just, yeah, I'm really sorry.
And I want enough time. I know, and I want enough time because there's one more question, and it may be that we spend the whole half an hour on this because I know there's so much to say, and I know you have even more to say, and I want to hear it. But unfortunately, I'm in a bad spot here. I don't want to cut you off, but I can actually feel the temperature rising to my left.
Thank you.
And I know there's a response here, and I think, Elena, you also had something you wanted to say here.
Yeah.
So can we do that, and then we'll come back,
mm-hmm.
and then we'll get, look at that. In that space, I got two questions. This is a very optimistic crowd, don't you think? Yes. Okay, so please.
Just quickly to address short-term curtailment of rights for long-term development, and I'll take the case of Ethiopia. And perhaps I really rushed through it in my 15 minutes. One is not talking about the fact that before the last elections in Ethiopia in 2005, nearly 30,000 people of opposition were in jail. I'm not talking about the fact that there's a problem that there's only one state-owned media. I'm not talking about the fact that the journalist who gets the highest award for journalism in U.S., Skinder Nega, is serving 18 years in Ethiopia. I'm not even talking about our researchers getting arrested, being on the field. I'm talking about what we mean by development. Here is a country giving away its best lands, is going to dam River Omo, getting ready for a conflict with Kenya as it destroys Lake Turkana, and Kenya has said it will go to war over it. We are not even talking about that to feed its own people. This is for cotton and sugarcane plantations for the Malaysians and the Indians. While this is a country where nearly 10 to 15 million people depend on food aid, and all of this is happening because these tribes are being told that we are creating these villages, the villagization scheme, where you will have better education and better water. The thing is, fieldwork on the ground shows nothing exists. When you have pastoralists who have 50 cows being moved, and you're told that you will have half an acre, it's not just a way of life that I'm trying to romanticize. You're killing people. So.
But you have to be at the mic, and you're going to have to get in line.
So,
sorry.
Definitely, I'm quoting from the extensive fieldwork.
We can't hear you on the video.
So, having
so you're
done
have
a
to
lot of fieldwork on the ground, your extensive time that we have spent, and it is incredibly hard to be able to spend time with the communities. Lower Omo is becoming more and more hard for people outsiders to get over there. The situation, which is not just one of my consent wasn't taken. This is about killings. This is about rapes. This is about detention. This is about heavy presence of Ethiopian Defense Forces. We have facts, we have figures, we have those photographs up on our website. So this is not about the Western concept of democracy. This is very much about economic, social, cultural rights. So long-term development, yes, new freeways and the rest in Addis, but Ethiopia with the big country, we're talking about basic needs. And again, not just a way of life, but about where more and more people are starving and what it leads to. So we have to have some indicators that we say that we are willing to sacrifice this for this. There is no this. If somebody can present what that this is, that it leads to better educated people, that it leads to better food security, it leads to more jobs. Of course, change your way of life. Lastly, about how the West has developed, European countries and US did not open themselves to the Ethiopians and Tanzanians and Indians for investment. They closely guarded the industrial development, they closely guarded the agricultural development before they became open for business. A very important, so did the Asian tigers. And I think the lesson is what you said. We are very glad to open up ourselves as developing countries instead of teaching our farmers not just to grow a few tomatoes, but we can have our own car industries, our own agricultural sector, which actually benefits, that we actually put the same resources in our farmers. Mark, today land becomes marketable in places like Zambia, where 94% of the land is customary. The minute it gets out of the hands of the local people, the minute it gets into the hand of private equity, Barclays Bank and the others just roll in the loans to get agricultural development happen. And it's an upside-down, backwards development model, which doesn't bring democracy, which doesn't feed people, and there's something inherently wrong.
I don't know who would ever get in her way, really. who would dare? I don't.
What I was going to say was very much included, I think, in what Anuradha said, which is it's one thing to suggest that certain policy is going to have positive impacts for poor people, mm-hmm. or even to say that it has positive impacts for a large group of people. But what you need to do is allow those people to participate in painting the picture of what's going on through these policies, so that you don't take a statistic that applies to a large number of people and mask injustices and inequalities that are contained within those statistics.
The decision-making process becomes critical. Who's deciding and who's going to decide who gets to decide?
And who's going to decide which information we're going to be relying
right.
upon in deciding what's working and what's not working?
Right, and the expertise, the statistics, and can we trust what we're seeing, all of these themes that you've identified become just highlighted in that scenario. Thank you very much. Do we have time? I'm going to venture that we do. Question number two.
Hello, my name is Martha Tritko, and I'm a student at the McGill Faculty of Law, as well as one of the student organizers for this conference. Thank you all for being here this afternoon. So I'd like to throw in four more factors to sort of heaten it up a little bit more. And I myself lived in Zambia in Western Province, and I can attest to what a statistic says does not necessarily reflect the reality on the ground. And I'd like to travel back to that reality on a personal level, an individual level. And I think there's four things we need to remember in discussing economic development, economic justice, et cetera, and that is local leaders. And in Zambia, as Anuradha said, a lot of the land holding is customary based on a chief who shares the land and rents it out to the local village. So when that land is taken, it doesn't just affect that one local chief. It affects the entire village who relies on that rental and customary system. So that's something that needs to be kept in mind in terms of the larger policies for a country that is frequently overlooked. The second is women and the role of women in promoting economic development. I was actually surprised at how little this was discussed this afternoon and would like to hear a little bit more about the necessity and the challenges of integrating women into economic development. The third is land registries. I was working in Timor-Leste where there is no land registry. So when we're talking about land grabs and people returning and people leaving and people being displaced, this is a huge barrier to economic development. And the final, I don't know if you're all aware, but currently in the United Nations in New York, there is an ongoing negotiations for an international arms trade treaty. And the linkage between arms and the extractive industries, particularly in Africa and DRC, is huge. And this is something that I think also needs to be further discussed. So I want to throw those four factors out to you and hear what you have to say. Thank you.
Now, my panel, what do you think about taking the other two questions mm-hmm. and then discussing all of them? Okay.
And quite different, I guess. I'm sorry, I was so paying attention to your... But I think I'll just get to the point very quickly without making some background statement. But I think increasingly we're becoming aware that aside from these very important questions of how to go about development, that even in developed countries, there are increasingly obvious problems of poverty and exclusion, which, and this also is starting to sink in, that also is related to a deficit in democracy and the participation of many of the people who are have-nots, etc. Alana Klein was addressing the issue of social and democratic rights. Hello, Alana. I think these are very interesting and new approaches that are worth hearing about. I'm not sure that the whole issue of accountability is mutually exclusive with other approaches, although there's a very serious problem of the justiciability of social and economic rights before the courts. I don't think we should abandon that approach at all, and it would have to be complementary. My question is this. Because I think that there is an important role in having governments, for instance, the Canadian government, but in Europe also, this is very much being discussed, of addressing issues of poverty, of telling people how they address issues of poverty, and then having a process of accountability. So this is an important value and approach. My question is there any legal basis to force them to do that? Because they're not doing it now.
That is a wonderful question. I ask myself that a lot.
Hi, my name is Alejandro, and I have two questions specifically for Professor Daniel. So you mentioned that democratic participation in Peru, and you framed it as a real democracy, but I'm curious about the political commitment that particularly in countryside, like what's the incentive that the government mentioned in the countryside area, like people go and vote, but they are interested more in what sense, like what economic incentives that the government promote into the countryside. So I guess that was the question, and then how the government, what challenges the government is facing in order to make this economic growth sustainable in a long term.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. So if I understood right, and I think what we'll do is just start here and go all the way down the panel, and you can each deal with whichever you want, but just to remember that we're talking about the four factors between statistics or, you know, what we think is happening in reality, the poverty and exclusion in developing countries. Can we force governments to do this thing that we all see as valuable? And the last one about challenges for sustainable development for the future. And I'll let you decide if you're going to answer all three or one, but I'll do this. There's 6 minutes left, so 1.5 minutes each. Okay.
So I'll just take the first one. I don't know if I can do it in a minute and a half, but within Africa, there are very different systems of land ownership. In case of Ethiopia and Mozambique, you know, the government owns the land. In case of Zambia, you have 94% of the land customary, where the chiefs come in. In Sierra Leone, you have that. In South Sudan, the new constitution recognizes private, communal, commons, and the state-owned land. Which again becomes a problem when we use the Western notion of land ownership. A lot of people, especially women who do most of the work on the land, of course, they do not have land titles. So on one hand, land registration done in a democratic way by the governments, which recognizes all these different systems of ownership, is important, and not just at the government level, but also, like in Sierra Leone, FAO had said that 85% of the country's arable land was not being used. And that was based, and that's why Sierra Leonean government was giving away its land to foreign investors. And our research showed that that information came from data collected 45 years ago. And in fact, no land was available for giving away. So that land registration, which is happening not just by governments, but different bodies, whether it is the civil society within the country or UN agencies or International Land Coalition, is incredibly important. I personally, you know, kind of cringe when people talk about let's start doing land titling, because if people, as you said, if people are poor, you don't have the rest of the microfinance, you don't have other support, the first thing a poor family will sell is the land to feed its people or to provide medical health care for a dying child or whatever. So that will be an important aspect. So I think we really have to, we personally believe in that each country requires or needs to have national consultations. Just quickly, Tanzania has a lot of work that we have done along with civil society came out last year, December, to say that they were stopping large-scale land investments. They'll focus on investments that target smallholders. And that is the kind of consultative process is needed within each country. You know, one-size-fits-all recipe for all the different countries in Africa or elsewhere will not work.
Thank you.
Okay, I think I'll address Beatrice's questions. First of all, are these approaches, that is the substantive violations finding approach and the indicator and data generation approaches, mutually exclusive? Absolutely not. I think that the one might help out the other. So one thing that I had sort of left out, so I always like to have these questions at the end, part of the reason why social and economic rights have received poor enforcement in countries like Canada is because of claims that we don't have enough information. We don't know enough, and courts will always say that. You know, we don't know enough about the impacts of our policies on people's lived experience. And so I think in a way it may be possible that you might try to develop these kinds of data-driven approaches in a way that's more inclusive in order to then use that information in relation to strategic litigation or even in, you know, if the Protocol on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights ever gets used and it just came into force, the optional protocol, the individual complaints mechanism, it may be possible to use this data that's derived hopefully through more inclusive processes in individual claims. So I would think that the two would be quite complementary. It's just that at the moment, we haven't done so well on the individual rights claiming, and maybe our time will come in the future. But I hesitate to be optimistic in an area where there have been so many difficulties, but I suppose that's one possible avenue of reform. And then the question is there any legal basis to require this kind of engagement? And I think it's the answer that you always get in human rights conferences, which is, well, we say it's a legal obligation. It ultimately amounts to a kind of cajoling of states to provide this kind of information. Is this, or to fulfill people's substantive rights? I think that, you know, part of the reason why advocates have turned toward this kind of approach is in part because of the fear that governments are hiding what they're doing. But it's also, I think, which I think is true, I think governments are increasingly operating at the behest of not their population, but other interests. But also I think the other sort of side of that coin is I think that actors are preferring these kinds of institutional choices because they think they can better cajole states into doing them. States are already collecting data, statistics, and information, and maybe the idea is, well, it's not so much of a push to try to ask states to do that in a way that includes poor and marginalized people in the data collection, in the data disaggregation, and so on. So is there a legal basis for requiring it? Only insofar as it generates as much consensus and buy-in that it starts being perceived as a legal obligation. It's always a very tough question when I'm asked whether international human rights are in fact legal obligations. And the question is, you look at the practice. Yeah.
You were naughty. Go ahead.
I'll tackle the women's issue.
Excellent.
I think, as I mentioned very, very quickly, I definitely think more women need to be involved in every aspect of society. Now, African women are not completely inactive. I think that there just hasn't been enough of a spotlight on the contributions women make to society. Now, having said that, there's still a long way to go. There are countries like Malawi, which only recently got inheritance rights for women. There are countries like Ivory Coast, where there were actually riots several months ago, where women were given the right to be equal heads of households. So if we're still dealing with basic laws of equal rights between men and women, women propelling to leadership will probably take a bit longer. Now, I think that there is a lot happening slowly and surely. I think there's a lot happening within this generation rather than older generations to really get women involved, but also women taking a proactive stance. I think social media has been a great tool for women to voice themselves and women to be very active. There are a lot of female techies around Africa that are making great strides in not only discussing development, but being very proactive about different issues within development. There are a lot of mentoring schemes happening slowly and surely. As I was explaining earlier, I'm in part of one. I'm a Mo Ibrahim Fellow, and the Mo Ibrahim Foundation basically decided that there were not enough young Africans learning enough about the international system and the way international politics works. So the idea was have a fellow shadow the head of an international institution to learn more about leadership. I was in the first batch of fellows, and that's why I'm at the World Trade Organization. And coincidentally, the first three fellows were females. The second set of fellows have also been females. And I think that that makes a very strong statement to say that we see the future of African leadership not only as female, but we do see the face of African leadership as people who we do need to be more exposed to the international system, which hasn't necessarily been the case in the past. We do need for these people to understand the value of current leadership, not saying that current leadership is necessarily the best, but knowing how it works in order to best come up with solutions in the future to make the necessary changes. I do think that there are a lot of women in business and a lot of women in not only microfinance, but SMEs. And I think that, once again, that is also the number of women in business is changing. The number of women in politics is changing. But I think that the problem is we, and I fault us, we are not telling our stories enough. So I'm not sure if we're just not being pushy enough to say we are here, listen to us, this is all the good that we're doing. I don't necessarily blame media. I really think that it's also partly cultural. The notion of shameless self-promotion is not there yet. And I think that we do need to adopt that and kind of say, you know, here are the strides that we are making. Now, having said that, I do see a lot changing in the next 10 years, but I still think that the basic legal infrastructure does need to develop before we can get to a point where women are equal parties at any table, be it business, politics, or civil society.
Or moderating.
Or the church.
Sorry, well, moderating pushiness right here.
I will
the
very,
last
I
word.
Will be very quick.
One minute, yeah, thank
just,
you.
Just to answer the last question about the and the relationship with the role of government and so on. When I finished my PhD in France 20 years ago, I came back to Peru believing in this idea that the economy must to be closed before and then open, and we have to protect the industries in order, the child industries, in order to develop in the future a competitive economy. And the facts that I live in Peru changed my mind completely. You know? And we have now a country, and the good news about the last question is the country is growing more in the countryside than in Lima. Peru used to be a centralized country, and now the best business are in the countryside. And that's mean this reduction in poverty. I don't know if you can put the presentation, but the reduction in poverty has been dramatic in Peru. And what happened is that the economic model is a consensus in the political frame. We just elected Ollanta Humala, that used to be a Chavist politician, and he changed completely his mind, thanks to, of course, of movement and Mario Vargas Llosa behind in order to modernize his management. And he's basically respecting the rule of the game that respect Ana Garcia before, that respect Toledo before, and we have the same policies, the same basic policies in 20 years. No, and that's something that generate this reduction in poverty, an open economy, and competitive economy. So, having said that, of course, we need to improve a lot in the institutions. We have a very bad judiciary system. We have still corruption around. We have a weak regional governments, and so on. No, and that's the main problem right now, as I said in my presentation. A weak state. We have to. We need a stronger state, but respecting the market economy rule of the game.
Thank you so much. I have nothing else to say. I could see us going on for another hour. There's so many things here that just didn't get finished. But I want to thank you all for your attention and for the wonderful questions. And I hope you'll join me in thanking this wonderful panel so much. Thank you very much. Do you need to make an announcement about where dinner is or anything like that? Does everybody know where they're going? Okay.